we're lucky. We had a lovely life. Quite tranquil, really. We lived in Newbury. We went to boarding schools, Bobby, my brother and I, and knew lots of people and joined anything that was going. There was a sort of roller skating rink and nice swimming bars on the outskirts. It was a nice little town. I had a lovely dog as well. We had an enjoyable life.
Before the war, we were living in London quite comfortably. I had a happy childhood up to then. Certainly no problems. We were poor by current day standards. My father was fortunately always in work. He always managed to find work. But we got by. You know, we were quite content.
It was always hard work. We always had to go to work. Leave school at 14, even though you wanted to stay at school. I wanted to go on, really, because I wanted to be a teacher, but it wasn't possible. Eldest of six, and you had to go to work. So I left school at 14, and the next day there was a job waiting for me. So you went to work, and you worked very long hours for no money at all. But everybody was happy. Nobody wanted millions.
Life before the war was very hard, as I recall. And my father, who was a plumber, was out of work continually for 2 years, which meant that we were existing on 30 shillings a week, of which there was 26 shillings for my mother and father and 2 shillings each for myself and my sister. And the rent was 15 shillings and tuppence, so they had 14 shillings and tenpence, which to live on, to buy food, clothing, heating. So it's all right for a week or two, possibly, but to try and keep it up for 2 years meant it was exceedingly hard.
As a family, we were happy, you know. I mean, mother and dad stayed together. Yeah, it was hard. I mean, we didn't have toilet paper. You cut up old newspaper or the Radio Times, and to use the gas was a penny in. But the electric meter was a shilling, so we had candles. We couldn't afford the electricity. We had lino floors in the bedroom and only rag rugs, which our parents made by cutting up old clothes. Yeah, it was a hard life, yeah.
I got scurvy at one time during that period because presumably shortage of fresh food, fresh vegetables. So my picture of pre-war life was that it was pretty tough. I mean, we couldn't afford to have the electricity on. Fortunately, there was a street lamp outside, and if we didn't draw the curtains over, that would give us sufficient light to be able to see, not strong enough to read, but you could save you bumping into the furniture as you were walking round the house. So it was hard going.
We used to have one good pair of shoes, which were for Sunday or wet days. Otherwise, our shoes wore right through, and we put inner soles of cardboard in. But by the time you got to school, the cardboard had worn away, and you were walking bare feet, really, underneath the shoes. And a thing I used to hate, my mother used to say, we weren't to slide, and I wasn't to skip, because that wore shoes out. Wasn't very pleased about that. On a Sunday, we always seemed to have a roast, but tea on a Sunday night would often just be bread and butter and lettuce. We never starved, but you always felt that you'd like a bit more to eat, yeah. Yes, it really was hard.
This is London. Please stand by for a few moments.
We used to listen to the radio, which there's quite a lot of pondering going on and discussion about it and so on.
In the 1930s, newspapers and the radio were full of the escalating situation that was brewing between us and Germany, and the feeling was that inevitably there would be war. Very worrying, of course.
I can remember quite a lot of preparation at school. The most frightening thing was that we were made to try these gas masks out. At first it was like fun, we all looked funny, but then after a while It was really quite horrible. And of course also we had to have pretend air raid. And we used to have to go off somewhere. It wasn't actually a shelter, but it was somewhere safe.
Well, before the war started, everyone knew what Germany was up to with the other countries, and so Mr. Chamberlain came back a year before the war started, waving the bit of paper and saying, peace in our time. But everyone was apprehensive, and so arrangements were being put in place for air raid shelters. We had an Anderson shelter.
Between 38 and September 39, we started to realise that things were becoming serious. The first thing that affected me in the build-up to the war was that we had not a large garden, but about three-quarters of it was vegetables were grown on it. But there was, just outside the kitchen window, a small lawn, and I would say small lawn, not about more than 6 foot square, but that was sacrosanct.
This little pocket handkerchief of a lawn in our back garden, my brother and I weren't allowed on it because we'd wear it out.
It always amused me that we had a couple of deck chairs, but we weren't allowed to put the deck chairs on the grass.
But that was where the air raid shelter was, so this precious lawn went.
So that had to be dug out. The man next door to us and my father worked together on both. He helped my father and my father helped him.
You know, you see all these men everywhere making shelters.
And this shelter was built of sections of corrugated iron. And then all that grass and soil that we dug out were then put back on top to try to give a bit of added protection.
When the air raid shelters were in position, my dad planted or sowed night-scented stocks on the side of them. Now, even to this day, the smell of night-scented stocks makes me think of my dad and the war. You know, that was one really nice thing about the air raid shelters was the smell of these lovely flowers.
It was on the radio and very sort of hushed atmosphere at home whilst we listened to it.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street.
We used to go to church, come home, have breakfast, and then start whatever we're going to do. But that day, after breakfast, we stopped whatever else we were doing and listened to the radio.
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us.
You thought all was going to be nice and nothing was going to happen because he had said so. Always been brought up to believe what people told me. I thought he told me there was going to be no war, but a war came along anyway.
I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
You had great faith in this man Chamberlain, though he was rather a weak character.
You can imagine what a bitter blow it is to me that all my long struggle to win peace has failed. Yet I cannot believe that there is anything more or anything different that I could have done and that would have been more successful. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
And my mother said, oh, my God. And she looked at Dad and they looked at each other. And my brother and I, we just felt, I don't know why, we just felt that they needed to be on their own. So we went out to the front gate and we just stood there without talking. We didn't really know what to do. And we went back in. And my dad said, the Germans will come here in planes and bomb our houses. And I looked up at the sky and he said, no, not today, but they will come. And I thought this was the most terrible thing, that these Germans, who we had never seen, would hate us so much that they would bomb our house.
I think I was out playing on the Sunday morning. I can't recall who told me that we were at war, but we went home and just listened to the radio.
In this grave hour, perhaps the most fateful in our history, I send to every household of my people, both at home and overseas, this message, spoken with the same depth of feeling for each one of you, as if I were able to cross your threshold and speak to you myself.
I didn't really understand things then, but I do remember going upstairs, lying on the bed and crying without anybody having said anything to me. I obviously knew that it was, you know, something that was really horrible that was going to happen to us, but without knowing quite what it would be.
For the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war.
My father had been in the previous war. He was 10 years older than my mother, so he wasn't going to be called up or anything, but I think my brother was looking forward to growing up and being able to go in the Navy, but he was too young when it started. There was a mixed reaction, really. Some people were quite excited about it, and others, especially the older people, were thinking of the loss of life. And no, it didn't occur to me to be frightened. I just knew we'd win.
Wonder what it feels like to be bombed.
Don't you worry, Ma. They won't come over here.
No, I suppose not. Still, you never know, do you?
In the early days of the war, as I recall it, the only sounds that we ever heard was practice by gunners. We never saw any aircraft. We used to get the siren sounding, and we all had to go into our shelters. And I can remember being very resentful that if I was in the middle of homework, I had to leave it and go down into the shelter or take it with me, where we then got very poor light to try to do any homework. And then hearing guns firing off without there being any bombs dropped.
My dad was a great stickler that the minute the siren went, we had to go down to the shelter. But I used to envy him because the men were meant to be fire watching, and we had some kind of stirrup pump or something because of incendiary bombs. And they would be outside talking and walking around, and we were sitting in this shelter.
The grand alibi for we married men, eh? 8 o'clock, and away I'll go with me stirrup pump. What? Don't take me sand. No sand. Gets in between your toes, doesn't it? Here, listen.
We had an air raid shelter in the back room, a large one, a large tabletop air raid shelter, which we used quite a bit, and used to get the woman in the flat upstairs next door, used to pass the children down to me, and I'd take them in, and we'd all share the air raid shelter together.
The government suddenly announced that every building had to be blacked out at night so that bombers and that wouldn't know that they were on a city. It didn't just affect houses, it affected buses, it affected cars. Buses had all their windows covered with a sort of pasted-on net, presumably to stop people being injured by flying glass. But also it cut down the amount of light being emitted, and at least half of the bulbs were taken out, so everything was a sort of semi-darkness.
Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are. Just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the porthole.
All houses had to have blackout. If you were wealthy, you could buy new heavy curtains, but if not, you could buy blackout paper and pin it up. Then this had to be done every night and then taken down every morning. You had to be very careful of opening doors or lights and that. Warden shouting, put that light out. And that sort of thing.
Last night I had fun. I went around and saw a light up in a lady's room. I showed up there. I said, put that light out. She said, what? I said, put that light out. She said, you come and put it out. You left it on. You've got to be careful, haven't you?
All the street lighting went off, so that you walked everywhere in the dark. But people weren't afraid.
But you were as safe as houses, absolutely as safe as houses. You could walk home in the dark and nobody or nothing would touch you, nothing. We were as safe as houses.
As boys, we became little horrors. We could go and stand outside a shop, perhaps three or four of us, and form an orderly queue. And people would join at the back. And then when there was about 12 people, we would just walk away. Nobody had ever asked us what we were queuing for, but it was in the minds, if there's three or four people standing there, they must be selling something.
Rationing? Well, we seemed to manage. We had dried egg, didn't we? And marzipan you could make with dried egg. We still had my Christmas cakes. We had margarine, which to this day I will never touch. We were restricted on sugar, so of course I gave it up so that my husband could have his sugar because it was more essential. Didn't worry me, just gave up sugar. Your children were more important than yourself, really. And your husband. I always seem to spoil your husband. I never came into it, actually.
Coupons will now have to be given up when buying clothing in just the same way as when buying food. Everyone will have 66 clothing coupons to last them for 12 months. And the first 26 coupons are in your present ration book.
One of the things that people forget about the war from a teenager's point of view is that money meant nothing, because it was no good having the money. You had to stop and think, not whether I've got the money, whether I've got the coupons. But I was going out with a girl then, and I promised that I would buy her a new pair of dance shoes for her 18th birthday. And I realised to my horror that the only way I could do that was using up some of my clothing coupons. And this is a figure that's remained in my mind since then. You used up 7 clothing coupons to buy a pair of shoes. And I remember saying to a friend, greater love than this no man hath than that he lays down 7 of his precious clothing coupons to buy his girlfriend a pair of dance shoes. I couldn't tell you how much they cost in money, but I do remember that they were 7 clothing coupons.
My mother, who was one of these very clever people, she became the managing director of Kunzel's, which they make cakes. They have restaurants as well. And she was in charge of all the restaurants. We were very lucky because if we wanted to, we could eat in the restaurant, you see. We could eat for free in the restaurant.
Well, our church started a youth club and my parents didn't object because it was run by the church. A thing that annoyed us, the priest came and asked us girls to give up 7 coupons each so that the boys could have football boots. Well, you can imagine that was not very popular, but the fact that he would expect girls of that age to give up 7 coupons for the boys, and, you know, we thought, well, why can't they use their coupons or their parents use their coupon? Yeah, that was a very annoying thing. Well, I don't think any girl gave their coupons up for that.
Everywhere, people had gathered at level crossings and on wayside platforms. Haymakers paused in their work to greet us. Men repairing the permanent way eased their backs to look up at us. And the children never got tired of waving.
It was really horrible. My mother didn't really know quite how to say to me that I've got to go away, and I didn't like it. And my mother was crying, I was crying, and of course we had to have this gas mask and a few clothes and sandwiches, great big label on us. We then went to school as normal. I don't think they really wanted us to say goodbye to our parents properly. They sort of hurdled us all together. I can distinctly remember walking down the platform. You saw a great big steam train come in, and of course everybody was sort of got on the steam train. and didn't know where we were going. And of course at 9, the journey seemed forever. I thought I was going to the other end of England. But of course it turned out we only went to Guildford.
When we got to Ivor Heath, we were put into groups and taken around to houses to see where we could go. The first place we went to, there was an elderly gentleman. Well, I say elderly, he seemed very elderly to us, came to the door. We were in the group standing at the gate, and we heard him say, "I'm not going to take two boys at my age. I can't look after them." We were then all marched on to another house, a little cottage, and... sorry, I get a bit emotional thinking about it, really. There, I say a very old lady, but probably she was in her 60s, something like that, but dressed all in black, as elderly people did in those days, came to the door, and she took us in, which was nice, but the change from where we lived in Fulham was terrific. It was only a very small cottage, 2 rooms downstairs and 2 bedrooms upstairs, no gas or electricity. The lighting was by oil lamps and candles, no bathroom and an outside toilet. But the big thing, she was very, very welcoming. We didn't really appreciate it, but when you look back at it, I mean, she was really taking something on, 2 14-year-old boys.
When we arrived at Guildford, we were huddled in a school hall. No real preparation for us whatsoever. And we were just going round the streets, and they were knocking on the doors. And most of them were saying, "No, don't want to take any evacuees, no, no." This was going on for quite a long while. And I think it got to the state where they were just saying, "Well, how many people are living here? How many rooms have you got, etc., etc.?" And they were saying, "Well, you've got to have one." So where I went, I wasn't wanted at all. I remember being pushed up into a bedroom, and I got my gas mask and my little case with my things in. I thought, well, do I unpack them or don't I unpack them? And eventually I thought I'd better. Then I suddenly realised I got a whole packet of sandwiches, and I thought, am I supposed to eat them or aren't I supposed to eat them? And eventually the lady came out and said, "Oh, you better come down now." And anyway, I stayed with her. I think it was about 18 months. Wasn't very nice. And she had a brother living 2 houses away. And more often than not, she would leave me all on my own and she would go to her brother. I remember one very frightening night. There was no light. There was only one bit of coal in the grate burning, and I was all there on my own. And I heard a knock on the door, and I thought to myself, "The Germans have come." And anyway, well, I suppose I'd better go to the door. I crept to the door. It did happen to be the lady I was staying with, brother. He definitely said, "You can't leave her there on her own anymore," and took me back. And that was a horrible experience. And, of course, I didn't know what was going on because we weren't allowed really to write home. The only thing we did do, when eventually they had school for half a day, one day they wrote on the blackboard a letter that we should write to our parents. And, of course, the letter had to say we were all happy, everything was all right, when it wasn't. And, of course, everybody had to send the same letter. My birthday's in February, and that was another sad thing because nobody said happy birthday to me. I did have cards from Mum and Dad, and that was about all. I didn't see my mother and father, I suppose, for about 18 months. And eventually, I went home when I was 13.
Well, my mother left my father, and we went with her to Birmingham, you know, to Solihull. I can't remember ever seeing him again. She never ran him down or sort of said anything unkind about him, and that was it. We just accepted it. When I was old enough, I joined up. I joined the Navy, and I said, well, what branch am I going into? And they said, well, we can't tell you, I'm sorry. Sort of rather thought it would be nice to be in the what I call the proper Navy, but I never was. We were trained in London in a sort of school, and we marched and saluted and did exercises and all sorts of things like that. And then we were all sent to various places, and I went to Bletchley. We worked at decoding. We sort of worked at these almost like looms. There was ticker tape that were all sort of in a huge room. We were told that it was a secret, and if anybody said anything, you wouldn't tell them anything about it. And I don't think anybody ever did. And then my mother was ill, and she was in hospital, and they rang me up. But they rang the chief officer, and they sent for me, and I spoke to Uncle Len, and he said, she's all right, and I don't worry about her. So I said, no, I won't worry about her at all, and I'm sure you're looking after her. Put the phone down, and I said, well, I must go. And they said, yes. And I did. And she died when she was 44. But she did try, you know, she didn't give in. And she used to sing to all the people in the ward, which used to make me laugh, really. Because they all had these radio things that they could plug in, but they seemed to like her to sing.
This is London calling. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead. I repeat that. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
Reports and correspondents say that the unconditional surrender of Germany to the Western Allies and Russia was signed in the early hours of this morning.
Must have just heard it on the radio. Oh, great elation everywhere. People seemed, I don't know, went out the doors, and there were a lot of street parties, and everybody seemed to go from being quite stern and miserable to really happy. That's what I can remember.
We heard about it from the officers where I was then stationed. And there was a local hotel that we used to go to, and they used to have dances, and then they had a big dance for all the people stationed there.
Oh, that was one of the best nights of my life. There was loads of empty spaces where there'd been bombed houses, and every field, every empty space had a bonfire on it. And my friend and I and two boyfriends, we went to all these bonfires, and we danced round them. I danced too close on one and set my hair on fire. But, oh, that was a most marvellous, exciting night. It really was.
I'd been called up at the end of July into the RAF. I'd been posted to Wimslow in Cheshire. Went there for 8 weeks, what they call square bashing. We didn't have radios and we didn't have newspapers. The war with Japan ended and I didn't know it had.
I always thought we would win because, being a person with a religious faith, I always thought that good, in the end, always wins over evil, always. And that was my belief all the way through the war, and it turned out that way, because I'm sure that evil never ever wins in the end.